December 2016. I'm your host, Jonathan Butrin, and I'm joined once again by the Ryan to my Gosling, Tim Nelson.
That's quite a compliment, John. Now, I know how you feel about Mr. Gosling.
You know the man crush, the level of it that I have for Ryan
Gosling. I do, and I'm feeling very appreciated right now.
Good. That was my intention. So, Tim, Merry Christmas. How was your Christmas?
It was fine. It was similar to last year. I was traveling all around the great state of Illinois.
Aha, Illinois. Mm-hmm. Great. Well, here we are. 2 weeks ago, we were here and we promised that there would be a second podcast in December as a special Christmas gift to all of you faithful listeners and, of course, a reconciliation gift for not having a podcast last month. We're sorry again.
Once again, my fault.
Tim's
fault.
For
your listeners that didn't catch the first December podcast.
Yes.
It was my fault.
And so last 2 weeks ago, we were here discussing Manchester by the Sea, and we are now today discussing the second big release of December, which is La La Land. Now, to me, this feels like the most hype movie of 2016. If you're at all connected into the film world, like you've heard about this, you've heard people's going crazy about this movie, right?
So my wife's not crazy about film. She mm-hmm. likes good movies. But this is one she's like, oh, I wish I could go with you too. And I was like, all right, well, we got to find a babysitter. But she's like, oh, forget it.
It happens so fast when you're a parent, yeah.
Yeah, but like most of the time I'm like, I'm going to go see the other guys. She's like, okay, have fun. But with this movie, she's like, no, I want to see this movie. I've heard about this movie. It got good reviews. I was mm-hmm. like, oh, okay. And so I think this is one that's not, it's a good movie, I think, but it is reaching a broader base than a lot of stuff that we review.
I was out last night to see it with my wife for the second time, and it was a Wednesday night, and the 7:45 showing was completely sold out.
Yep.
Like a Wednesday night. I couldn't even mm-hmm. believe it. So yeah, it's definitely reaching a broader audience than just film buffs. And especially if you're in the film community, you've heard great things from critics. Like I've seen this at the top of a lot of top 10 lists of 2016, and I have personally been looking forward to this for a very long time. And I'm so glad we finally seen it. So we both have, and we are ready to talk about it and whether it lives up to the hype.
All right.
So here we go. So before we can talk about La La Land, I think we have to start with another film by the name of Whiplash.
Whiplash.
Because the writer-director of La La Land is a guy by the name of Damien Chazelle, and his first major film came out a couple years ago, and it was called Whiplash. Now, he did have a debut movie. It was called Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench.
Which, actually, this... Do you want to talk about this later? But this movie is actually, this is kind of like the prototype for the movie that we just watched.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I know this was his passion project from before Whiplash, and he did, but he couldn't make it until after that became a success, right?
So it is this technically his first movie, but it really is forming the basis for La La Land.
Yes. So, I mean, for all intents and purposes, Whiplash was his big debut, and... yeah, it basically was a hit for him. I mean, it made a good amount of money. It was nominated for multiple Oscars. J.K. Simmons won an Oscar for it. He's the one who plays this teacher of a band that basically is, in his mind, he is trying to get the most out of his students and push them beyond what they're capable of. Some would call it abuse. Throwing symbols at them, insulting them. He thinks that it's the only way to really discover what someone's capable of. So, Tim, describe your thoughts on Whiplash from 2014.
So there's two movies that stood out to me in that same period, and Birdman was one of them, and Whiplash was the other. And I think it's because you had this extensive use of drums in both of those, right? And then also because they were pretty revolutionary filming techniques. One was like, they're both used long shots. One, Birdman more so. But I think of those two being to get like kind of revolutionary films that happened at a similar time. I think of Whiplash and I think of the idea of two human beings. Do they make each other better? Do they make each other worse? What is the limits? What makes great art? There's a lot of these themes that go on, but I think it's really a movie about struggle. And struggle the struggle of an artist. So I think that that's always going to be interesting to some people.
Yeah, it's interesting when you compare Birdman and Whiplash. I think I've told this before, but I totally put them together in my mind because I saw them back to back on the same night. Birdman first and Whiplash second, and they it was just an incredible night of film for me. Like, it's just one of those memorable theater experiences because you're right. Both of them have this pumping soundtrack and this and Whiplash ends in that amazing climax, you know, with the drum solo. And so I just walked out of the theater with my head spinning. Like, I couldn't believe what I'd just seen. And they happened to be, in my opinion, the two best movies of that year. And so to take it all in that 4-hour period was just incredible. I recommend the back-to-back experience, actually. If you're going, if you haven't seen Birdman and Whiplash, do a double feature because it'll blow
your
mind.
I like it because you're looking at It's talking about what is art in both of those.
Both of them, right, yeah.
What is good? What does it take to be the best at something, right? And you're getting it one from the perspective of a 19-year-old and the other one from the perspective of a 65-year-old.
Hmm.
And I like watching those two movies together. It's weird that I have those in my mind together and that you do too.
Yeah.
But the idea of artistic struggle is like in both of those. Am I any good is like the primary question, right? That you see in both of those. Am I any good?
Yep.
Could I get better if I worked really hard and I gave everything I had? Could it be good? And then, so I think that's interesting. And then what's also interesting is the one that they're made by, the first one, Whiplash, is made by a young person. And then Inuyuritu did the other one, right?
Inuyuritu, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he's like, what, in his 50s?
He has to be. I don't know for sure.
And so like you have those two characters that are very similar to the directors. Inuyuritu has been around for, what, 15 years?
Mm-hmm.
Like really on the scene for 15
yeah,
years.
Right.
And then this guy's brand new. Chazelle?
Chazelle. I looked up the pronunciation on some French website. It's Chazelle, hopefully.
Yep.
That wasn't being bamboozled. But yeah. So, I mean, what's really excited for me about Damien Chazelle is that he's just getting started. Like, so Whiplash was up for a bunch of Oscars. It was his calling card. But now, and so now La La Land is his second major movie. And just the level of talent this guy who is young is displaying so far boggles my mind. I mean, like, where is he going to be a couple years from now or 20 films from now? I think this is a talent, like, to watch out for. Because, I mean, if you think about directors, there's usually a learning curve, right? Like, Spielberg didn't start off making Jaws. It was early in his career, but I mean, there was.
He did the truck movie.
I was just thinking that.
I can't remember the name of it.
What is it called? I don't know. But right.
Duel. Yes. The two trucks?
Yeah.
Or no, it's a truck and a car. I can't remember. I watched it before, but you're kind of like, it's high suspense, but you don't remember anything.
Right. Yeah. But no one's going to put that up there with, like, you know, his masterpieces. But, I mean, Whiplash, as, like, your burst onto the scene, you can't ask for a better movie than that. So I just think this guy's going places, and I mean, he's already arrived, and so it's great. And so what grabs me about Chazelle, from my perspective, is like, I just feel like he's in control of his movies so well. Like, he has masterful economy to his writing and his directing. I feel like every line is whittled down to its most punchiest, bare, you know, razor sharp thing, and there's no fluff to me.
So he took a year to edit this film.
A year.
Just to edit the film. He had everything else. He took a year to edit the film with a partner. That's a long time.
That's incredible. Yeah.
So I think you're right. Mm-hmm. Not just in the writing. I'm sure he goes through editorial process in that. But I think you're right. There is great economy.
And it feels
shots
like
and everything.
Right. Like, you know how this film is split up into seasons and everything? Like, the scrawl that comes up that says spring or summer, it comes at, like, the perfect time. You know, in the opening scene when you see the title La La Land, it comes with, like, a punch in your face. Like, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Sometimes I'll watch, like, an opening credit sequence, and it looks like they literally just threw some words on the screen to, you know, and, like, no one put any thought into you're already entering into the atmosphere here. But a moment matters to him. Yeah.
It's funny that when you mentioned those spring, summer. So the other film that does that I was thinking about recently is Requiem for a Dream does that.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't even think about
and
that.
And I don't know if that was trying to allude to that or not, but that's a pretty well-known film.
It's one of my favorites.
I mean, the guy might have been 15 when that came out, but still. Yes, I don't know, but that's another film that does that, kind of like looks at similar chronology, saying this horrible thing could happen in a short amount of time, and La La Land's more like, this great thing could happen in a short amount of time.
Well, yeah, but what do you think, when you look at both of his films, is there something that stands out that you think he brings to the table that no one else does?
I mean, I think he's really an emotional filmmaker. Not saying that he's not a logical filmmaker by any means, but I think he gets the idea of this, it's a very young struggle. Like, I was forget to call a friend that's like, there's some line from a movie that talks about when I was young and self-improving. He's 31 years old. And so he's capturing this stage in life that he's still in, which is the young and improving stage of his life, and he's capturing all these struggles that he's gone through. He's a failed jazz drummer, basically.
He was in high school. Yep.
But yeah, and then very successful filmmaker. But he also he moved to L.A. in 2010, and he wasn't a successful filmmaker at that point. Mm. He had this one prototype film. Mm-hmm. And so I think he captures this struggle, the young artist's struggle, he captures really well.
That he's still in the thick of, you're saying, yeah.
Well, and he might be done now.
Right. I think La La Land's going to seal the deal on that one, yeah.
I think so. I don't know. But the idea between, I think, is this good? Is this, am I taking, like, am I exchanging something good for what the best thing could be? So it's a very young way of thinking. It's very, and I'm not going to use the millennial word. Oh, wait, I just did. But it's the idea is like FOMO almost in all of his films. It's like, am I missing out on something that I shouldn't be missing out on? You have that in Whiplash where the guy's like, well, should I really be locking myself up until I've been drumming till I bleed?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Or should I just have relationships with people and like enjoy life? You know, have a girlfriend and not be so one-sided. And then there's, then there's the other part of that. I see this in the other film too, where it's like, well, maybe I should just go home. I've been doing this for the Emma Stone character. I've been doing this for 6 years now. Maybe I should get a job. And so it's the idea of this real struggle in the artist. And I think he really captures that well. And it's a place that he can speak from.
Absolutely. And then, of course, there's the musical element that he brings. Like you mentioned, he's a jazz drummer in high school, and music forms the foundation of both of the big movies that he's done so far. So, I mean, in Whiplash, you had this very, I mean, it was a, basically Naaman in that movie was him. Like, he was a jazz drummer. And then, obviously, La La Land is a musical, but it's clear that, like, jazz is very in his bloodstream.
Yeah. He uses that as a metaphor for all kinds of things. So, like, the idea of jazz, like, when and this gets pointed out by the Gosling character in the movie, who's just some, you know, jazzophile or whatever.
Right.
That jazz is really like people trying to, that are playing off one another. It's always a different song. Every time you play, you know, you can like have music that's a jazz standard and play through it. But like the best jazz is where people are just riffing off each other and they're, and in some cases trying to dominate one another. And then, and they're kind of increasing, like they get a chance to try to do that. And then the next person tries to do that even with it. And they're working together. So it's kind of an interesting idea as far as relationship goes. And you see that in both of these films.
Absolutely,
you see that
yeah.
this guy's trying to dominate his students in order to bring the best out in them. Yep. So that they will, and then at the end of that, of Whiplash, which if you haven't seen it too bad, you should have seen it by now. At the end of Whiplash, he dominates the teacher.
Yeah.
I mean, like there's like this real push-pull. It's pretty interesting stuff. And so it's the idea is, well, could two people, and this is the jazz metaphor that you have, because the jazz metaphor is, well, hey, we're in real time in jazz. What other music is in real time? Maybe like a jam band, but that doesn't count to me. Like real time music where you're playing, you're basically reacting to other people, and those people hopefully will bring out the best in you. And sometimes you're trying to dominate them, and sometimes you're not.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is that it's bringing out the best. And so I see those themes in that metaphor as being throughout these relationships is that, hey, human relationships are like jazz, dude. I mean, he's kind of telling us, human relationships are like jazz. We bounce. Sometimes we try to control each other. Sometimes we try to be in charge. Sometimes we're just sitting here in the backbeat and we're hanging out and we're seeing what's happening. And then we try to add our piece. But I think the whole thing is like that actually creates better art than if we were isolated and on our own trying to do things.
You think about Emma Stone's auditions in La La Land, right? She's totally on the bottom of that power dynamic.
Oh yeah.
But then in her one essential audition, they basically, there's no script. They're just like, tell us a story, and she has to improvise. And yeah, you're right. That metaphor shines through in both of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's good. So La La Land is a modern-day musical, and Tim has famously said, I hate musicals.
Yes.
Those are your words. So describe, Tim, why you hate musicals, please.
Typically, I look at a musical as being something that's trying to make money and please the crowd. It seems antique to me. I don't, not that I disrespect musicals, but I generally am not a huge fan. Sometimes the songwriting can be witty, but I want like something that's character driven, not driven by a song. And then the characters are kind of like window dressing for it. Mm-hmm. Song and dance is kind of like, to me, circus stuff. I'm being critical here. I know. It's kind of like goes, well, hey, this is stuff they probably did in vaudeville that kind of made its way into cinema. But do we really need this? Because we can do whatever we want with special effects and we can do what we want now. So why do we need to have stuff that people did around campfires? Like, that's how I feel about it.
That's fair. Yeah, I mean, I see where you're coming from. I mean, there's, I don't love musicals personally, and there's this heightened reality in them that can be a blessing and a curse, right? On the one hand, I think characters bursting into song can be kind of distracting and showy and even annoying at times. I mean, I know this is utter heresy for musical lovers, but I struggled with Les Miserables, like how every single line is sung, and it just feels so, like, too much, and it's distracted me from the story. Whereas one of my favorite musicals would be West Side Story, which I know, like, music people are like, did he just diss Les Miserables and praise West Side Story? But
Les Miserables, right? So, like, yeah. I guess, oh, people are going to hate me too. They already hate me when I talked about campfires. But anyway, Les Mis is like this, class in the French Revolution and, like, these huge themes that, like, impact, like, they're like a meta. It really impacts our meta narrative as we reflect on these themes, and to have like people goofing, kind of like launching into goofy songs to me,
right,
doesn't really make sense. Apparently, I'm wrong as far as the money goes. People liked it, yeah. And I know there's some good songs in the movie. That's great. All right, whatever. But but from my standpoint, like just having read the book, I'm like, the book's better than the musical. Come on, right? Maybe I'm just erring in the direction I want that I like.
But to be fair, to be fair about that heightened reality, I think there is a beauty to it that, especially in today's very cynical world, musicals kind of present this alternate reality where people handle their conflicts through singing and through melody and elegance. There's a civility about musicals that I think is kind of necessary in our very nasty times we live in. I don't
like
know.
When Michael Jackson in the video Beat It got those guys to stop knife fighting and they started dancing. Is that what you're saying?
Not exactly.
It's kind of exactly kind of, that.
Kind
but
of.
That, but that's no. I get what you're saying. You're saying that it's a softer. It's like comedy in some ways.
Well, to an extent, like even like West Side Story, where you have these gangs that want to kill each other,
but
they fight by dancing and by having the wittier lines in the songs. You know, there's just something about that that's like different than if you were to film that live action and just being about people throwing vulgar words at each other. There's something that's kind of beautiful about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But at the same time, as you said,
art fight. Is that what you're saying?
Basically, yeah.
In the cafeteria, we should yell art fight and then have a big dance-off.
It's all about the art fights. All
right, man.
But your musicals are only as good as their songs. I mean, there's kind of, if the songs aren't good, what can you do? So I, as someone who hates musicals, Tim, what did you think about the songs in this particular musical and kind of describe what kind of musical we're dealing with in
your
estimation?
It's a jazz musical. I liked it. I liked it. It opens with a musical scene, which kind of sets the tone for, hey, people are going to talk in music. Okay. And you're going to have to deal with that, Nelson. I'm like, okay. All right. But I think they did a good job, well choreographed. It wasn't so over the top because you had decent characters. There's a couple of scenes that were kind of over the top, but I think that goes with the territory, right?
Well, but you're right. But I think what you're saying is that it's a little bit more of a subtle musical than you might be used to if you're into musicals, right?
Right.
Especially like from Les Mis. I mean, this is like the opposite kind of musical from that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
I mean, there are some in-your-face songs that are big, but like for the most part, there is a lot of regular dialogue.
Pastel colors everywhere. Right. Like, I'm not the guy that's sensitive to these things, but man, like the place, it was just bursting with color. It looked like it was from a different era.
Yeah.
And I think that was intentional. I was reading some stuff that said, like, as far as like musicals, like it's or just like stylistically, it's borrowing from, I guess it's the New French School or something. Which there's a bunch of these different directors that were reacting against highly literary films that were based on novels, which apparently was like the big thing in the 30s, 40s, and part of the 50s in France. And I guess here too, right?
Right.
And so they reacted, and this is one of the ways they did it. So it's like this artistic reaction to stuff that was too heady in some ways, or didn't allow for, and musicals do this, didn't allow for kind of nonsensical expressions or absurdity to be expressed. I think musicals do that.
So they reacted by letting loose and...
Yeah, well, they went like kind of surrealistic.
Yeah.
So I would say like it's like reality but on 11, right? Mm-hmm. So everything's brighter. Everyone's dancing. And instead of people sitting in the freeway, I'm blowing the first scene, but instead of sitting on the freeway and just like being on your cell phone and being pissed or listening to the radio, people are dancing on the freeway. So it takes something that is... that would be normal life in LA, because I've done that for hours and hours of my life, days of my life, sat on the freeway. In fact, even probably sat right there.
Tim lived in LA for years.
For years. And so it takes those normal things and it says, well, no, there's something special about this. Or it makes those moments kind of, you see how they do it. Like they take a boring moment and they turn it into something special. So they kind of make it sacred, right? Through musical.
And there's a community element to that too, right? You're in your car in a traffic jam and mad at each other, and what if you came together and did something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the reviewers I was reading this week was saying, this is the anti-Magnolia movie, which is an LA movie that's like highly acclaimed.
That's good.
And he's like, we're basically, and it's a musical too, and everyone sings that Amy Mann song by themselves in the rain. Singing in the rain. There you go. Uh-huh. No, but the idea is like it's anti that.
That is so.
So it's
true.
Like this is a different era. This guy's like, no, this isn't how it's going to be. This is going to be,
though. The biblical apocalyptic frogs in that movie is what brings everyone together in the end. But there's definitely more.
That's true. Yeah. It's true. So some horrible event in L.A.
Magnolia
versus it's sunny, that for 20 minutes. Beautiful. You're looking at downtown L.A. from the 105 freeway where
it's
the speed.
Night and day.
Speed bus jumps off. Yeah, absolutely.
So I saw La La Land twice, and I have to say I connected with it a lot better on my second time. I'm really glad I saw it again, and that kind of scares me because I feel like there's probably a ton of other movies that I've only seen once and unfairly criticized for whatever reason, and if I had given it, you know, two or three more viewings, I might have come to understand how it all fits together, but it's kind of the plight of the film critic, right? If you're seeing 50, 100 movies a year, you can't see them all two or three times. But still, all that to say, I didn't love the songs on my first viewing because I think I went in expecting bigger, I don't know, just like how typically in musicals, it's like everything hinges on the songs and everything quiets down and then you have this song. Whereas I felt like though you had a couple bigger moments in this movie, it feels more like the songs are pieces of the whole. Like there's a lot of them are just a couple lines, but they feel more like jazz riffs, right? Just a few bars of something rather than a big song. And that kind of fits together with which what it is a jazz musical. And I think once you understand that and you get in the rhythm, you like let the movie dictate the rhythm instead of what your kind of predisposition is towards musicals, the songs are really good. And I've been listening to the soundtrack a lot this week, and you had it playing when in the background when we were setting up, and they're good songs, and it really does work. Yeah
I mean they took the time to write good songs.
And I remember him saying that in an interview, that they went through like drafts upon drafts of songs and they didn't get it until, or didn't land on it until they were sure that this is the best it could possibly be. Yeah.
Yeah. And it wasn't so one of the things you could become is a Disney movie if you're not careful. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Right.
Where it's campy and cute or Shrek-y. Like,
and
that's
it borderlines it. It like comes up to the line and peeks over it, right?
So you have to be really careful that you don't use your songs as like these ways to like get cheap laughs. And there's a little bit of that, but not a ton. They function as dialogue. And so And sometimes soliloquy, even like when you're when she's giving her the casting toward the end of the movie, like where she does a response to the casting call to tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't.
Right.
She sings the story.
Right.
And it's a very serious story, and she doesn't break character to sing it. She's herself. She is that character. And so, like, that's very different than, Timba and Pumbaa jumping around, or, you know what I mean? Like, I think that's the musical that we would all be familiar with is kids' musicals.
Right.
Which would be cartoons.
Newsies.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, we have to cover your least favorite topic, the acting. I'm sorry. I know this isn't your thing, but it can't be avoided. So the two principal actors in La La Land are Ryan Gosling, who plays Sebastian, and Emma Stone, who plays Mia. And these are great characters. They're really well written. I think we connect to them instantly, and you couldn't ask for two better actors in these roles. Do you have any thoughts on the acting? Feel free to pass. I know this isn't your thing.
I always love Emma Stone. I think we talked about Birdman on one of these.
Yep, yep.
And she's great. So my thoughts were like, I just think she's a great actress. I know that they've been romantic comedy pair in a couple films, or romantic.
Crazy Stupid Love, were they in together, I want to say?
I don't remember because I hadn't seen any of them.
Yeah.
That's not my primary plot line that I'm like going after when I go, ooh. But that's just because I'm an old cynical guy. But they've been in films together before, so they're drawing on some of that chemistry that he saw in that whoever casted it.
And they do have chemistry, there's no question. Yeah.
Yeah. So I thought that was good. I like the Emma Stone character because she has she's a beautiful actress and has the chops to act. And you can see that in when she's doing casting and nobody's paying attention, you're like, wow, that was amazing. Like when she's on the cell phone.
Oh, yeah.
You're like, oh my gosh, she's amazing.
And then how do you even just cry on spot like that? I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
And they're trampling all over her, which just adds to it.
They don't even listen to her. I know. And so I thought her acting was good.
Great. I would say Ryan Gosling's acting is good. Like, and it's not, okay, I think Ryan Gosling's perfect for this role. Like, I wouldn't change anything about his performance, but if you're comparing, if you're talking about a legendary performances or Oscar-worthy performances, since this is the season, Emma Stone is the one deserving of the Oscar here. I don't think Ryan Gosling should even be nominated.
I don't see any Oscar performances in this movie.
What?
Yeah, you don't
think Emma Stone should be nominated for an Oscar for this?
No, I think you could. I think you could have put anyone in those two.
Excuse me?
Yeah, I really do.
The voice.
These weren't even first choice actors. This project got shelved, and these are like third choice actors.
I disagree with you wholeheartedly. I think not only is it an Oscar-worthy performance, I think she's going to win.
She's too old. She's too old.
Amy Adams. I like Amy Adams, but come on. She couldn't do it.
She's too dark, isn't she? Yeah, I know. No, but you could put any number of young actresses and a young actor in this spot, and they would have been just fine.
Mm-mm.
In fact, if you had a younger male lead than Gosling, I think you actually would have done better.
He's wrong. Everyone. Tim Nelson's wrong.
Let's just put Tom Hanks in there.
Well, when Emma Stone wins an Oscar, I'm going to text you, and we'll see.
You could say, I told you so.
Yeah, just like you're going to say, I told you so for Casey Affleck.
Wins an Oscar.
Yes. Well, I mean, and I don't know. And you might be right about that. I just want to see what the noms are up against. But anyway, so yeah, I love Ryan Gosling, but I think Emma Stone wins the day on the performance here, and she very well might win an Oscar. We'll see. But she's great. And I really like the love story between these two because it's unconventional and just clever. Like, you know how typically when you have a love story, you have like they finally come together for the first time and everything falls away and we see this like love at first sight thing? This is not love at first sight. The first time these characters see each other, he's honking at her because she won't go on the highway and she gives him the finger. That's the first time they see each other. And they have a couple more very unpleasant encounters after that. So I love it because their relationship feels really earned. Once you finally get there, feels real.
And they meet up over a course of months before they actually like have a real conversation.
Yes,
like they encounter each other over the course of months.
So, the if case you haven't seen the movie and you're totally like don't understand what this is about, quick plot synopsis.
Oh, good.
The movie takes place in LA, and Mia is an aspiring actress, and she's out there auditioning and pounding the ground and trying to get noticed. And Sebastian is an aspiring jazz pianist, and his dream is to own a jazz club because he thinks jazz is dying and people don't understand how good it is, and he wants to have a club where he can play jazz the right way. And Mia wants to be a famous actress. And so the two of them meet, they each have this dream, and they kind of help each other pursue their dream. But over time, things get complicated, and there's a tug of war between their dreams and their relationships and reality, I guess. So that's kind of the basic plot of the film, and there's a lot of twists and turns. And this is anything but a conventional love story, which I love.
It is, but it isn't. It does have all the conventions, which are...
But it's twisted on its head.
It's different. It's different.
Before we get too honed in, though, on what's at play, I want to take a step back and appreciate the film from a technical level. I think from a purely technical standpoint, this is a masterpiece. Just the way the camera glides in and out of each shot, the costumes, the lighting, the unbroken takes. What did you appreciate from a technical side?
You're asking the wrong. What did I appreciate?
Yeah.
I appreciated all the location shots. And the reason is those are not easy shots to get in LA. And so you don't always appreciate that. But Griffith Park at sunset or sunrise, one of the two, dusk or dawn, is not an easy shot to get. And the other shots like Angel's Flight, not an easy shot to get. They're all incredibly crowded, busy places that they have to do on location filming. Now, I know this is LA, so they do that.
Right.
From a technical standpoint, I was really amazed by that. They use a lot of Griffith Park. The freeway scene, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Like, I can't even, get on the freeway, and they shut it down.
How do you imagine they did that? Like, shut down a highway? I would think people would be very upset about this.
So, I think the carpool lane stuff, they basically, I mean, I don't know how they did it. They got some permit, and they shut down the carpool lane, and they made it look like two lanes, or maybe it is two lanes. I think it's just one, if I remember correctly.
Oh, so the highway would be still operational, and it's like the carpool lanes.
Yeah, so they have carpool lanes in LA, so it's just so instead of, we have carpool on-ramps, they have whole lanes just for carpooling. And so that would be the carpool lane that they shut down.
Nice.
Yeah, and it made it look like two lanes, I think. But anyway, but that's a lot of to do during the day, the times they picked. All those things are really difficult things to do. It had a whole bunch of different location shots. The Rialto Cinema, that's a cinema.
It's a real place.
I used to live over there. And I've actually seen movies in the Rialto. It actually closed in 2007. It's on the historical register. But that's where they watched Rebel Without a Cause.
Yeah, and Emma Stone goes by later and it is closed.
And it is closed. And it has been closed. But the idea is like this old dying thing, just like jazz, right? The Rialto is this old dying thing. Rebel Without a Cause is this old dying thing. The style of filmmaking, musicals are an old dying thing.
Yes. And the way that Chazelle kind of melds the past and the present. This movie feels to me like it's both old and new at the same time, which is a heck of a thing to pull off.
Well, look at her apartment, right? So we're talking, her apartment has Ingrid Bergman film posters and like Lilies of the Field film posters. And then her roommates all dress in a different color pastel dress. So it's like really, it's like Hollywood Hills apartment. It's like really trying to get us to go back. It's pointing to this like old film style. Mm-hmm. So everything is going, go back, go back, go back. This stuff's not junk. This stuff is not junk.
But it's still modern. Like they'll have this this moment where they're dancing and like these old classic musicals. And then her cell phone will go off with that trademark iPhone ring. So that's what's kind of funny about it. And at the same time, just really beautiful is this old and new and one doesn't win out. It's just perfect blend.
It's a nice millennial observation. I didn't even see it. But look at the John Legend's in this too. We didn't talk about John Legend. He just basically was John Legend. But he goes, so he's playing this kind of new fusion-y kind of jazz.
Yeah, he asks Ryan Gosling to be in his band, and he is a fellow jazz student of Sebastian's younger days, but he is kind of trying to do this new thing with jazz, kind of take it to a more contemporary level, which Sebastian doesn't quite like.
Yeah. He doesn't like it, and he's like, no, I want to stick to my old stuff, and I want people to appreciate the old stuff. And he's like, dude, they'll never – he's like, nobody's listening to that. They are listening to this, and this is jazz. He's like, well, it's not the kind of jazz I want.
Well,
so
and
there's
he brings
this tension,
up,
right?
He brings up a legitimate point that the jazz pioneers that Sebastian loved so much were revolutionaries, and they brought the genre forward, whereas Sebastian's kind of stuck in the past, and he's playing to 90-year-old people who appreciate that kind, but yeah.
So it's this idea, this stuck in the past, and that there has to be some, we talked about dialectic all the time in when we talk about these different films, but there's this dialectic of old and new, and then it creates something fuse or different. I think that's jazz too, right? That metaphor is jazz, even though like jazz is dead, right? But apparently it's not dead because John Legend is using jazz fundamentals or whatever to make this career for that's a highly successful band in the movie. I think the same thing, the musical itself is kind of like, it forced me to listen to jazz for 2 hours. Did it to everybody in there.
Absolutely.
And he did the same thing with Whiplash. He forced us to listen to jazz drumming for 2 hours.
And we like it.
And we think, and we're like, oh, this is great. And then, but would you ever like put on a Charlie Parker album?
Absolutely not.
I would. But like I'm an antique. I'm a dinosaur. Yeah. Okay. So I'm old and crotchety.
No, I see. I'm the kind of guy that like Quentin Tarantino watches 100 movies and then he makes one based on all those movies. And I'm like, I'll just watch the Quentin Tarantino version. You're like, I want to go watch the 100 movies that he based.
Well,
on.
He's like pointing us to 100 movies in this film and a bunch of jazz albums. And, you know, I mean, because you put posters of other movies in your film, you're like going, go watch that film.
And did you? OK, because I'm not that caught up on a lot of the older movies, but there's a point where they're walking towards in the studio area and they roll by a poster of a film with like a couple on it, and I want to know what that movie is because it has to be insanely important. Like they literally do it slow, just like walk by with a poster. I'm like, that's probably the key to the whole movie, and I have no idea what movie it is.
I did not notice, but there's other, like, you know, there's stuff that's like old musical stuff, so Singing in the Rain. But like I said, this French school, like there is like the first scene is homage to this new French kind of movie school, and the idea, and there's actually there's scenes in like, I think it's, I forgot the guy's name, but it's Demi is his last name. There's actually a scene, in one of his films. It's like a musical where they all come out of cars and they start singing in the square.
Oh really?
Okay. Yeah. And then there's another one that's a traffic jam scene in another one of these French movies. That's in the same period of the 50s and late 50s, early 60s.
There you go.
Where they're in a traffic jam and they show, basically roll through the whole traffic jam to show what what life was like for different people. And you see that in the first scene of the movie too. So I think it's really it is like a lot of movies right now, which is very strange. It's like we're trying to get some kind of grounding, right? It's like, what is good? What is good? What is good? Because I think we're having an aesthetic crisis right now.
Yes.
We always are. They probably say that.
You could say movies are kind of having a crisis because everything is so geared toward TV right now that there's a lot of people who think movies as a genre are kind of dying off.
I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
Huh.
Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
No, but I think, yes, it's like, what is the foundation? And I think we looked at another movie, Hail Caesar, is like, you know, Caesar is like hailing these old movies that we think are can't be junk. And they said, no, this is great. I think this movie itself is functioning in a way that allows us access to old things without making without having the movie be dusty. And I think that's where he's brilliant. That's where the brilliance is.
It's good. I love the unbroken takes. Like, this isn't like Birdman where the whole movie feels like one take, but I feel like within every scene, it feels like they don't cut away. And I don't know if that's true, but it feels like it.
In Birdman.
I'm talking about in this, it feels like within every scene, the camera just glides around and they almost never cut away. Like the one scene in particular with Mia where she's auditioning, she has her big moment with her song. Like, she apparently, I know that scene, they did not cut away at all. They just go zoom in around her and then come back out. And she also sang that live as well. So, and I think there's a lot of that, which is pretty incredible. So, not talented. That's incredible.
I said Gosling wasn't talented. Okay. I didn't say
you
she
said
was.
Emma Stone could be played by Amy Adams, who we don't even know can sing, by
the
way.
Yeah, we do. She's in that princess movie.
Oh.
Enchanted, isn't she?
Yeah, that's
in your
right.
face, Sean.
I had to see that once.
Right. See, and that's what a musical is like for a lot of people. That's what I'm saying, okay? But I think it's pretty impressive. It's a pretty impressive movie. I think we agree with that. What do you think the name means of the movie?
Oh, I think I know what I take it to mean, but I got to get to that when we get to the ending, which is very soon. But Well, let's just do it. Let's do it.
Should we go for it?
We're going to go for the ending.
All right, man.
Right now. So, okay, guys. Here's the deal. We are going to have to spoil the ending. There's just no way around it. We can't talk about it legitimately without spoiling it. So if you haven't seen the movie, go pause this, go see the movie, come back. We'll be here. If you don't care, proceed. But this is your spoiler alert. Okay. So, Tim, I'm going to start off by just describing in brief the ending of the film, and then we can tear it apart.
Okay? All right. Go ahead, man.
Here we go. So, as I mentioned before, there's two dreams going on here. Ryan Gosling wants to own his jazz club. Mia wants to be a successful actress, but they find each other, and there's this genuine, magical love that they have, and we see this in it. Just the movie does a remarkable job of kind of capturing that feeling of first love, even when they're watching Rebel Without a Cause and they're gliding their hands toward each other. You know, that I remember doing that when I was in high school with the girl that I liked. There's just something about it that feels forbidden and wonderful. So they're in love, and we see the magic of their love and its true love, but there's also this pull that they each have toward their dream. And basically, the movie has a bunch of different circumstances that unfold, but when you finally get to the ending, we see that Mia and Sebastian have both achieved their dreams. Mia is a famous, successful actress. Sebastian owns his jazz club, except they are not together anymore.
They're not together.
Mia has a husband and a child. And immediately, right when you see that, you're like, oh, they're never going to get together because you can't break up a marriage with a child, right? So it's like, So that introduces this amazing conflict.
Our two ideals are at odds with each other.
Yes.
He's not going to break up a marriage for true love. Jeez.
Sorry. But so they each have their dreams, but they're not together. And so what happens is Mia with her husband actually happens upon Sebastian's jazz club, and they see each other and their eyes lock. This is 5 years since they've last seen each other, and suddenly it all comes back, like what they had. And Sebastian plays this piano solo that's sort of the theme of their relationship throughout the whole movie, this one sort of series of notes. And we see this amazing montage of what could have been if they had stayed in love and stayed committed to each other. We see how everything would have unfolded in this alternate reality, and that's the ending. And then we cut back to the reality, and they are still not together, and she leaves the club. So that's the ending. It's a heartbreaker of an ending, and that is what we are going to talk about now. So Tim, go ahead. What is your take on the ending of La La Land?
So I think it's doing what the film promises. It's a jazz ending, right? So the idea is, like, you had these two people who made each other better for a while. And like in the Emma Stone character, she was like, when he achieved a level of success where he was kind of complacent about it, and she challenged him. She said, no, this isn't who you are. Are you playing the music you like? She asked him real simple questions. Is this who you are? So this authentic, honest person that he needed in his life to ask that question, because everyone else was pointing him to do the thing that's going to give you a paycheck. And he needed another artist to go, is this what you like? Is this what your dream is? And then for him, for her, She went home. She ran away when she had a bad audition.
But he pushes her, too, to do this one-woman show, to stop marching.
He drives hundreds of miles to go pick her up for an audition. Mm-hmm. And he pushed her to the one man. He's like, no, this is great.
Which leads to her success, yeah.
So basically, at these critical times, these two artists who are seeking to like have their song in the world, right, push each other at these critical moments to get to this next level of artistry. And they're pushing each other and pushing each other. And without each other, they would never have hit this next level of artistry. But there's a point, and this is the same point in jazz, where you have to let the soloist have the solo. You've got to stop, and you've got to fade back down and let that person who at that moment is taking the lead. And he even says that. He's like, you're going to have to go on your own now when she reaches a certain level of success. And she kind of knows that's true. And I think that for him is like human relationships. I feel like he's saying something in that, which is this artistry doesn't guarantee a happy ending, but that the art itself will be elevated because of it.
So you think that what they're saying is that at the end of the day, even though they had this relationship, that they're better for it in the end?
I don't know if they're better for it, but is the art better for it? Hmm. Yes, there is a jazz club. Yes, there is. She's writing this beautiful stuff, and it allows her acting because she's a great actress, right?
Right.
A great actress is acting. And so I think for him, there's always, and this is the same thing within Whiplash, there's always this tension between great art and human relationship. And he almost sets it up like you can't have both. You can have one or the other.
He does.
And I think that tension he exploits still. And we got to remember, this movie is actually, you know, in his writing, this movie is actually first. Whiplash
right,
is second.
Right, right, right.
It's an easier movie to make. So it's more commercially.
You don't have to edit it for a year.
Right. No, I mean, you can make Whiplash at a community college. Take a few establishing shots in New York, right? Uh-huh. But yeah, so I think those are, you know, they're very different movies. I think that tension is really key. And I think the idea of timing in each other, that our relationships in each other's lives and the right timing can produce greatness in one another. And that doesn't necessarily mean that we're committed to each other forever, which is kind of a weird idea, right? Oh, you don't like it. Of course you don't, right?
So here's the thing. When I saw La La Land the first time, that's exactly what I got from it too, is that they were basically saying, look, we had something that was true and it was awesome for the time, but we at some point have to follow our dream. We have to follow our heart, and we've gotten to where we need to be, and that ultimately is what's more important, and I hate that. I think that is a horrible message, and like I think it's even offensive, because if you think about like this whole idea of following your dream and making it, quote unquote, how many people actually make it in the world, right? How many people go through all these auditions and actually become the famous actor? I think you can count them on your hands. I remember reading an interview with Bryan Cranston, who is the Walt from Breaking Bad, and he said that when people in his film school that he acted with, they were two or three of them that had more talent than he will ever have. Like he couldn't believe the level of talent that he acted with, and yet they're still haven't, quote, made it while he has. And he was arguing for the fact that it's not just talent, you also need a huge dose of luck to make it, right?
Right, it's a ticket to the, it's a lottery ticket.
Yeah.
The talent is.
Exactly. So that's the question. So this idea of throwing away love that is right in front of you, true love, for the lottery ticket, I think is a horrible message.
Here's a question. Is it an authentic message?
It might be true to the La La Land of Hollywood, but I don't think it's true to what is actually true, what we know to be true. And so when I saw it the second time, I got a different vibe. I actually think that what Chazelle is doing is the songs are all pumping that message that you're talking about, right? Like the opening line of the film is this song talking about how I left that guy at the Greyhound station and it was true, but I did what I had to do, right? And Emma Stone's song is talking about how here's to the mess we make, you know, but we got to do what we got to do. I think that is the dreamland of Hollywood, but actually it's destroying people and it's getting people away from what actually matters. And I think that in the end, the movie is more of a tragedy. I think the ending is saying these people will... they have their dreams, but they will never be truly happy like they could have been if they had focused instead on the love they had.
Totally disagree with you.
Okay.
Because if they never had their dreams, they would still be striving.
I think
and
that...
And they'd be together, but they'd be striving.
I'm not advocating throwing away your dreams. I think your dreams need to be in service to love, right? And we know that the ultimate commandments we've been given and the way to live our life is to love God and love our neighbor. And it's not that we throw away our dreams. It's that our dreams need to take a different shape, right? So we have passions because God's given us passions. It's not like, hey, you know, don't throw away the stuff that you're really interested in. God's actually laid that on our heart. But the question is, do we pursue the dream because of the dream and to, quote, make it in the world's eyes? Or do we pursue it out of love for God and love for other people? And that...
Well, I think we can put our message on top of this film if we... I think if we – no, don't – not me, because I'm serious. I think we can take our message that we want to put on the film, mm-hmm. or we can take the director's message.
I think that is the director's message. I mean, not as detailed as I just said, but I think the fact that – I think it's a tragedy, and I think he thinks it's a tragedy in the end.
I think he's playing with us because we think it's a tragedy. Hmm. Like, I think that the fact that we react against it is because it's going against what we want for those characters. It's not necessarily going against what would be the best thing for either person, right? So to me, like, I look at, I think your examples are exactly right. So where you say, here's to the dreamers and the mess we make. Is that what it is? Something like that? That's the song. Mm-hmm. I think that's the film. And I think the other, you might not like that message, which you have every right to disagree with that message. I would say that's fine. It could be a total false message, and that's okay. But I think that's his message.
I don't think it's his message. That's
really
when I watched it again. First time I thought it was. The second time, when you watch that last scene and you see the horror on Mia's face and on Sebastian's face, I think they're broken people because of the decision they made to follow their dream over their love.
Oh, I'll watch it again, but I think I'm going to struggle with that. I think that we're in the right tension as far as the space that you and I are occupying right now is the right tension, because the idea is like, I think he's asking us, is the art or the relationships more important?
If you could.
Yeah.
What's your dream?
I don't know. I can't condense it in a 20-something.
Let's say on a purely worldly level, I would love to be a successful screenwriter. Right?
Okay,
successful Hollywood screenwriter. If you were to offer me that, but I have to give up my wife and my friend that I have, that I walk through every day with, no question.
Yeah, I know, but it's not usually, but that's not life. Life doesn't come in a Faustian bargain. You know what I mean? I think life is much more... like the film, which is we make these small decisions over a course of time.
They made the wrong decision. That's my whole point. And I think that's what the film is arguing.
They both achieve what they hope to achieve. But it does kind of get you into, and it's not, and her husband looked like a nice guy. I mean, they're not portraying this guy as a bad guy. She had a beautiful little kid. She achieved what she wanted to achieve.
It's Ryan Gosling.
Well, I understand that you're sad for Ryan. I don't think he'll ever be with Emma Stone.
How can you turn down Ryan Gosling?
Yeah, but I think that if you're feeling that tension, if I'm feeling that tension, I think that he's got us in the right spot, because no matter where our opinion is on it, I think he's got us in the right spot, because I think that actually is a real thing. I mean, I look at look at the great artists. You know, even within our own kind of literary tradition, they seem to have given up quite a bit, or have taken quite a bit. So I think about Hemingway, right? Hemingway's this great, he's like this total like force of destruction all around him. Self-centered, narcissistic destruction, fueled by alcohol. And he produces some of the greatest art. Hmm. And I look at, there's a lot of artists like that, right?
Yeah, the tortured souls produce good
art. Look at jazz musicians, right? Charlie Parker. I mean, almost all these jazz musicians are very, I guess now we don't have as much of that, but these heroin addict jazz musicians. And I think the idea is like there's a high price to art. Yeah. And I think that you see that within these, I think within the musicians, even that, I think these jazz musicians, you can see it more in the Whiplash movie. There is a high price to succeeding in your craft. So, yeah. Anyway.
But you would agree that if you're right in the movie is saying that your art should take precedence over all else, that there's an emptiness that comes from that, right?
There's a high price.
High price.
Yeah. So I would say there is a high price for the dreaming. They would say the messes that you make are real messes. I think it's interesting. What's the name of the movie, the Stars one?
Which one?
I mean, the name of the song. There's a song in it that's like the leading song, something about the stars.
Oh.
I'm forgetting that.
I'm sorry. I don't know. Where he just sings about like the city of stars.
City of stars. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Which is funny because you can't see the stars in L.A.
Is it smog?
Well, the smog, but also there's so much ambient light you can't see. You can't see the individual stars very well, so they have to go to that observatory to see them. That's like when they fall in love, right? Sorry, this is a side note. I've just been thinking about this all day because that didn't hit me when I was first watching the movie. I was like, oh, yeah, I couldn't see the stars out there.
I was thinking about... that verse in 1 John where it talks about not loving the world or anything in the world, you know, which has obviously been taken into horrible legalistic rants about not, you know, dancing and having playing cards. But I think what it's actually referring to is this idea of not buying into the what the world's buying into, as far as like on a deeper what they're living for, right? And I feel like this message, if which is the message of LA, of you just got to keep going, and if you break some eggs, that's how you make an omelet, I think is a very destructive message. And I think that we would say that that is what like kind of First John is saying, is that if that's your goal, then you could end up with nothing. Yeah.
So I was thinking, like, on this ambient light thoughts. Sorry, I'm like going off. This is my thought today on the movie. So I hear that, like, you know, this idea of like that we are, how this is like a whole theological topic that you're bringing. It's a good topic, but anyway, my brain's very ADD, and I was thinking about like ambient light and the idea of like you can't have two lights too close together, or they basically blur into one, and there's like no distinction anymore. I was thinking like maybe that's like one of the things, like with this whole stars idea, is like the idea is like, if they're too close together, like neither one of them is, they won't be even visible. Like they'll blend into each other. But anyway, that's a weird idea. But but the idea being like, if they'd stay together, could they have succeeded? I don't know.
But that's what doesn't matter in the end. I feel like if you are holding your dreams in the right way, if they're in service of love, your dream will look different than certainly what the world considers successful. Mm-hmm. But it will be more fulfilling in the end, right? You hear about like cooks or something, famous chefs that are using their businesses to in service of the poor and things like that, right? That looks stupid in the world's eyes. It's like, why don't you pursue five stars and be, but it's a different dream, but ultimately it's more satisfying. That's my point.
Well, I think like Apostle Paul, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if we're gonna go, like, let's go.
Yeah, let's
hit it.
It's what we're...
So I think there are certain things that I think that you will not do if you're following, let's call it a dream. That's what we're calling in the movie. But like, let's say you're trying to follow God.
Yep.
I think that there's certain boundaries on that, even relational boundaries, that you're going to keep.
Exactly.
And so from within that, like you're thinking of like the marriage boundary, I'm thinking of like singleness boundary, right? So I'm looking at Paul, and Paul's like, this is a boundary I keep because I cannot do what I'm supposed to be doing if I don't keep this boundary. I mean, in Whiplash, he keeps a singleness boundary, right?
Hmm.
And or food boundaries or circumcision, well, all these boundaries you see in the scriptures, but the idea is these boundaries are really important if you are doing what you're called to do.
Right.
Now we've talked in dreams, like these people have these dreams which seem very self-serving, but I think you could take that same idea, put it onto like, you know, these saints, and say, you know what, they had a lot of boundaries that they were unwilling to go through too, and they departed from one another at certain points. I mean, I think of the book of Acts, I think of people that joined each other and that people that departed from one another, depending on the circumstances.
Mm.
So there is like this, and it wasn't always like hunky dory, and it didn't always have this great relational feel.
Right.
A lot of times it was very
in
painful.
Pursuit of their calling. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So I think like there may be something to this from the sense of calling, like that maybe we have to do some really difficult things
pursuing what we're called to do. That's interesting.
Yeah, that might mean that like that might say, well, your personal relational fulfillment may not be may not happen.
And if we're going to reject Gnosticism and we're going to say that, hey, being an actress isn't necessarily less valuable than being a preacher,
no.
Is it conceivable that, you know, that mm-hmm. yeah, that it's not as self-serving as we might think on the outside?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, I mean, I think if we're, I mean, I see it that way. I think mm-hmm. that's a good point, mm-hmm. which is like, hey, look, these, we're not like, we're not baptizing some professions and then, you know,
yeah,
demonizing
exactly.
other ones.
Yeah.
But no, rather we'd say, no, like, this is like being an actress is a high calling. And if you're a believer in an actress, that's like, you know, you have a great responsibility. Hmm. And so there are certain things that there's certain boundaries that you put on it. And I think they seem to have like a real sense of like boundary and call and all those other things. They're not call, but like their idea, they had a telos, they had this goal, this end that they wanted to see, and they were willing to do something about it. And I think that's kind of admirable, right? I don't have that. Like you're asking, what's your dream? I'm like, oh my gosh, get through the day. I'm in my late 30s. These people are in their mid 20s. Yeah, they've got big dreams. I'm trying to get it through the day and get dinner made.
I'm with you, my friend. All right, so let's close this thing up here. Go ahead, Tim, your final thoughts on Whiplash with your letter grade. Let's hear it.
I'd give it an A. I think it's a good movie, and I think we will see something, not Whiplash, what is it? La La Land.
Mm-hmm.
And I would definitely predict that we will see it in some of the categories come the Academy Awards. So there you go.
There you go. I agree. I give this film a solid A. And let's just take a moment and recognize that straight A great movies don't come out all the time. And so we need to appreciate them when they do. I remember Birdman and Whiplash, I both gave A's to. Mm-hmm. I didn't give an A to a single film in 2015, the following year. So this isn't like, and those are the only two movies I gave A's to that year. And this and Moonlight are the only two I'm giving it to this year. So these are great. We need to enjoy and cherish the great movies.
Did you give Manchester an A? Minus?
I did.
Really?
I did.
What did I give it, an A?
You gave it an A.
Yeah, yes. So those are my two.
It's an A minus.
Yeah. See, it's a good season.
It's a great season. This has been such a good year for movies. But this is a great movie. So definitely see it while it's in theaters. Don't wait for DVD, because you're going to be that person watching the Oscars going, oh no, now I'm stuck in this waiting period where it doesn't come out for another month. And
the format was shot in this different, was it CinemaScope?
CinemaScope, and they have the official. This is a theater movie.
It's a theater movie.
And you want to see it with other people too. It's a beautiful thing, yeah. So see it now while you can. It's extraordinary filmmaking, and this guy, Damien Chazelle, is so talented, and I'm just going to be watching his career like a hawk from a technical standpoint and acting, the whole nine yards. There's just so many moments in La La Land where it's like, that's why we go see movies. Mm-hmm. This perfect explosion of music and visuals and acting and writing, it all comes together, and there are scenes in this movie that are definitely my favorite of the year, so it's a great film. I'm giving it in A for sure. So that's it, man. That is our review of La La Land, and this is the last Cinema Faith podcast for 2016.
Nice work
to you too. I so love our times together, and I'm looking forward to a whole brand new year and new slate of films. Who knows what's going to come out next year? I usually like January and February are still seeing some of the movies from, you know, getting ready for Oscars.
It feels like the
official year doesn't start for me until like March.
It's like after the Super Bowl. Then we can talk again.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to, though, saying goodbye to 2016. This has been quite the year from a current events perspective, from a deaths perspective. Carrie Fisher passed away a few days ago, and so I'm ready for a new year, and ready for a new year talking film with you, man. So the movie is La La Land, and it is playing in a theater near you. Keep the faith, my friends. We will see you in 2017.